Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, listeners have likely heard about the Massachusetts miracle, the health care plan passed by Massachusetts legislature and favored by Governor Mitt Romney made front pages last week, with many accounts calling it a plan for universal health care. Our guest says that's just what it's not. So how are the press getting it wrong? We'll talk with Steffi Woolhandler, associate professor of medicine at Harvard University and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. Also on the show, a contributor to the New York Post's Page Six gossip column tried to shake down a subject for hundreds of thousands of dollars for protection against negative coverage in the column. We'll hear from New York Observer columnist Joe Connison, who says the gossip columnist may have been just following the example of Post owner Rupert Murdoch, who has long used his media holdings to trade favors and punish enemies. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
Counterspin often talks about media's skewed pundit spectrum, which allows for far-right voices like Sean Hannity and Pat Buchanan, but can't seem to find any true progressives to represent the left. Sometimes, though, the situation just gets a little absurd. Take Time magazine's Jill Klein. A vocal supporter of the centrist Democratic Leadership Council, Klein frequently takes positions that place him far from the left end of any dial. In April 2004, for example, he wrote that the ideal step for Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry would be to pick hard-right John McCain as his choice for vice president and, quote, announce a government of national reconciliation composed of moderate Democrats and Republicans, close quote. More recently, Klein's rhetoric got downright vitriolic against the left, as Eric Alterman reported in his April 11th MSNBC.com column. At a Council of Foreign Relations discussion in Washington on U.S. relations with Latin America, an audience member raised a question about whether Democrats would be able to field an electable presidential candidate in 2008, to which fellow audience member Klein shouted, quote, "Well, they won't if their message is that they hate America, which is what has been the message of the liberal wing of the party for the past 20 years," close quote. Of course, everyone's entitled to their opinion, but as Alterman points out, Klein represents the most liberal voice on Time's columnist roster. When the most liberal columnist Time can muster parrots right-wing talking points about the left, we just have to ask again, what liberal media?
The Valerie Plame story found its way back into the media last week as Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald filed new papers that shed a little more light on how the White House planned to undermine Iraq war critic and former Ambassador Joe Wilson. According to the court filing, Dick Cheney's former aide, Louis Libby, was instructed by the administration to leak portions of a classified national intelligence estimate in order to counter Wilson's claim that the White House's story of Iraq's attempts to get yellowcake uranium from Niger was unfounded. Some reporters shrugged it off, suggesting that everyone in Washington leaks information. As CBS Evening News reporter Gloria Borger put it on April 6th, quote, "This is just one more opportunity for Democrats to charge the administration with hypocrisy. But, as one former intelligence official told me today, if hypocrisy were a crime in Washington, we'd have to build more jails," close quote. NPR analyst Daniel Shore summarized the story on April 8th by saying that the intelligence estimate, quote, "came up with the possibility that there was indeed an attempt to buy uranium from the country of Niger," close quote. So the White House was very anxious to get that out. But that's deceptive. Some analysts did think there was something to the Niger story, but others vehemently disagreed. The White House wanted reporters to know only about the analysis that backed up their ultimately bogus case. But the Washington Post was the most passionate administration defender. Its April 9th editorial, headlined "A Good Leak," argued the White House was right to go after Wilson since he was the one not telling the truth. Washington Post readers were surely confused to read in the same day's paper a long story reporting that the intelligence estimate did not say what the White House was saying it did. And since the White House itself long ago admitted it shouldn't have made the Niger claims at all, the Washington Post is left defending the administration on a claim even they no longer stand by. Now that's loyalty.
An ongoing U.S. military propaganda campaign aimed at exaggerating the importance of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the purported leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, was reported in the April 10th Washington Post. The report, Military Plays Up Role of Zarqawi, says the effort has raised Zarqawi's profile, quote, in a way that some military intelligence officials believe may have overstated his importance and helped the Bush administration tie the war to the organization responsible for the September 11, 2001 attacks, close quote. The propaganda not only targeted Iraqis, hoping to turn them against the foreign militants. According to Post reporter Thomas Ricks, it also, quote, explicitly lists the U.S. home audience as one of its targets of a broader propaganda campaign, close quote, and boasts of how, quote, a selective leak about Zarqawi was made to Dexter Filkins, whose resulting article ran on the New York Times front page on February 9, 2004, close quote. Ricks quotes an Army colonel, seemingly shocked by it all, who tells him, "You don't psyop Americans. We just don't do that." Indeed, psyops, or psychological operations, military speak for propaganda operations, which target Americans, aren't just against Army regulations. They're a violation of federal law. But anyone reading all the pumped-up stories about Zarqawi's role would have to suspect that, denial aside, they do it, and successfully. Of course, some outlets are more receptive than others. According to Ricks, U.S. Army psychological operations officers also produced a video about Saddam Hussein's human rights record that was widely disseminated inside Iraq and was also seen on Fox News.
What's the big story at CBS News right now? Depends what you call news. Virtually all eyes are focused on new evening anchor Katie Couric, how many millions she will make, how the Today Show will do without her. The degree of excitement in 2006 about the very idea of a female reading the nightly news is certainly one indication of the current state of serious journalism. But there's another, some would say more important story at CBS that isn't receiving anything like the attention. CBS cameraman Abdul Amir Yunis Hussein was recently released by the U.S. military after the 25-year-old had been detained for more than a year. An Iraqi, Hussein had been shot while filming a celebration in Mosul that turned violent. But while he was taken to a hospital and treated, he was also arrested by soldiers who he says called him a terrorist. U.S. military refused to let CBS News see any of the evidence against their employee, but they made charges, via unattributed leaks to the press, that Hussein had been standing near a man who was inciting violence, and that the film in his camera showed that he had been involved in other insurgent activities. None of those charges amounted to anything. The supposed film of other incidents in his camera didn't even exist, but that didn't keep Hussein out of Abu Ghraib, where his widely known employment with a U.S. media outlet no doubt made him few friends. He finally had his day in court April 5th, where it was determined that there were no grounds on which to prosecute him. A journalist working for a U.S. media outlet imprisoned in Iraq by the U.S. for a year on baseless charges. No, it evidently wasn't interesting enough to a press corps engaged in measuring Katie Couric's perkiness factor. News of Hussein's release was limited to wire services and a mention on CBS itself. Perhaps one turnoff to the story was that telling it would have meant engaging opinions like that of Hussein's brother, Mohammed, who told AP, quote, "It was as if the Americans were trying to frame him, to cover up the truth, the fact that they shot a CBS News cameraman, a journalist who was doing his job," close quote. And he added, quote, "They're making a lot of mistakes. It would be better for them to leave," close quote. None of the soldiers involved in shooting Hussein have been disciplined.
Finally, on his April 11th Fox News TV show, Bill O'Reilly turned to one of the things that he loves to hate, the Air America Radio Network. The hook for O'Reilly's comments was the announcement that the Liberal Radio Network CEO was being named vice chair of the company and a new CEO was being sought. O'Reilly framed that news this way, quote, "Air America CEO Danny Goldberg has been replaced as the death watch continues on that ridiculous network. The radical radio fest is being propped up by far-left millionaires because it cannot make enough money to support itself. The federal elections people should look into Air America because it is obviously not a viable commercial enterprise. It is simply there to help liberal political candidates." So according to O'Reilly, if a media outlet doesn't make money, then it ought to be investigated by the government as a possible violation of election laws. That would be bad for O'Reilly's boss, Rupert Murdoch, who in addition to owning Fox News Channel, owns the New York Post, an outspoken conservative newspaper that loses an estimated $15 to $30 million a year. That would seem to make it obviously not a viable commercial enterprise. No doubt Bill O'Reilly will be calling in the feds any day now.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The April 6th headline in the Sacramento Bee was typically celebratory. Massachusetts miracle. Politicians agree on health care for all. That found an echo at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, whose April 9th report on the bill, recently passed by the Massachusetts legislature, was headlined, Health Care, Coverage for All. Other outlets added the tiniest of qualifications. The New York Times April 5th front pager announced, Massachusetts sets health plan for nearly all. And the Los Angeles Times editorial had it that the bill, quote, could, if it delivers on its promise, make Massachusetts the first state with universal health care, close quote. But those interested in actual universal health care will want to hold the champagne, because the information that these stories tended to push to the margin or even off the page turns out to be crucial. So what more do you need to know about what many in the media are comfortably calling the Massachusetts miracle? Joining us now to fill us in is Steffi Woolhandler, co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard University. She joins us now by phone from Cambridge. Welcome back to Counterspin, Steffi Woolhandler.
Nice to be here.
Well, the New York Times lead said that with this bill, Massachusetts would become the first state to, quote, provide nearly universal health care coverage, close quote. Even with that nearly in there, does that statement work for you?
Oh, absolutely not. We are not going to get to universal or near universal coverage with this bill. The legislature started with a phony number. The Census Bureau has been saying that 750,000 people are uninsured in the state, and the legislature decided they liked the number 500,000 better. So they just sort of assumed away about one-third of all the uninsured people in the state. But more serious than that is that the linchpin of this plan, the thing that's supposed to create universal health insurance, is a mandate that uninsured people go out and buy their own health insurance. And the problem, of course, is that the reason they don't have health insurance in the first place is because they can't afford it. And there's nothing in the bill that's going to make health insurance more affordable for most of our uninsured in the state. There's going to be some subsidies for people, perhaps up to 300% of poverty, but 300% of poverty is only $29,000 a year for an individual. So an individual earning $29,000 a year is going to be mandated that they have to go out and buy an individual policy, which costs about $5,000 a year in this state. So that's a non-starter. People are not going to have the money to purchase the insurance, and we're not going to be able to get to universal health care.
Well, it's fascinating because many stories seem to treat what would seem, even to somebody who's not particularly up on it, to be gaping holes in this plan as if they were mere asterisks, sort of minor things to be figured out later, like how we're going to pay for it. That information was in articles, but it often seemed to be kind of ancillary. Maybe I'm being redundant here, but isn't a plan that says everyone must get insurance without saying how insurance will be made available for everyone, even on paper, isn't that just half a plan?
Well, it's probably less than half a plan. There's been a lot of talk about giving people affordable, comprehensive policies to purchase, but that's a little like saying you're going to give us chocolate chip cookies with no sugar or fat or calories. That plan doesn't exist in the state of Massachusetts. In order to get the cost of health care down, you actually need to change the system. Specifically, you need to get rid of the private health insurance industry with their paperwork and high overhead costs. Doing that would let you save about $9 billion in the state on administrative costs, and then take those savings and use them to provide care for everyone. Now, that's what those of us who support real national health insurance have been saying for years, but the legislature did not want to step on the toes of the insurance industry. In fact, the insurance industry was jubilant about this bill because all of the new coverage will be purchased from the private health insurance industry. And there's been a lot of talk from the governor about how he's going to allow the health insurance industry to sell these stripped-down, skimpy consumer-directed health policies, these plans that say they're a health insurance policy on a piece of paper but are so full of holes of co-payments, deductibles, and uncovered services that even if you had one of these policies, you would be bankrupted by a major illness. So the insurance industry lobbied for this, and the hospital industry spent $7.5 million on lobbying that we know about, and they're the real victors in this new bill.
Well, there were some potential criticisms that media went out of their way to dispel. CBS Evening News found a source to say, quote, "It would be a mistake to think of this as some crazy liberal pinko kind of Massachusetts taxachusetts. The important thing is this is a moderate proposal," close quote. And ABC likewise had someone say, quote, "This was not the liberals cramming something down everyone's throats," close quote. I didn't hear a lot of discussion of what you've just said, who was actually pushing the legislation, that $7.5 million that went to lobbyists, but surely looking at who pushed it might give some indication of who stands to benefit from it. I did want to ask you, though, in the wake of it, some healthcare advocates do seem to be supportive. What accounts for that?
Well, the one group that is actually helped by the bill is people who earn less than 100% of poverty. There were some real improvements in coverage for that group. Now, only 11% of all uninsured people in the state earn less than $9,000. That's 100% of poverty. But those people were helped, and that's great. We celebrate the fact that the very poor in the state were helped. But there's many poor, low-income, near-poor people who are not going to get the help they need and are going to continue to face a dilemma, either try to pay an unaffordable premium or go without health care.
Can you respond to Governor Mitt Romney's statement as reported in the New York Times that, quote, "This proves at this stage that we can get health insurance for all our citizens without raising taxes and without a government takeover. The old single-payer canard is gone," close quote. I'm not being facetious here. What is the single-payer canard, and how does this dispel it?
Well, the single-payer canard, I guess, is the view that the only way we can afford to cover everyone is through some form of national health insurance. And, of course, every other developed country does use national health insurance to cover all of its citizens. We're unique in the developed world in having a system based on private health insurance. But the experience of other countries does seem to indicate that you can get much more affordable coverage. You can actually afford to cover everyone for all medically needed services if you go with a single-payer system and get that administrative simplification and administrative savings. So I think that's the single-payer canard, that single-payer allows you to pay for health care and actually afford universal coverage, and other things like this bill simply are not affordable.
So a lot of other countries seem to have fallen for that single-payer canard and to be doing all right with it. Well, finally, there's such overt editorial celebration around this plan, and much of the coverage has had a tone of left and right coming together. Isn't it wonderful? NPR's Daniel Schorr said that the plan, quote, "shines like a nonpartisan good deed in a naughty partisan world," close quote. I don't want to explore that, but it seems to set up a situation where if you complain now, you're just a complainer. Do you think that this is going to make activism for truly universal health care harder?
Oh, absolutely not. I've been getting calls from all over the country of people saying, "We don't understand that there's no universal health care here." This is not fooling anybody who's really thinking seriously about health care reform. You just have to look at the bill and say, where's the universal health care? All this is just an unenforceable rule that people go out and try to purchase insurance. I think, you know, there's a bigger problem of the media covering policy from a he said, she said point of view, and oh, the Democrats said this and the Republicans said that, hence we've covered the issue. The media needs to be actually looking at the policy. They need to be reading the bill, or at least reading the summary of the bill, and figuring out whether the bill will actually do what it says. You can't take politicians' claims at face value. Everybody knows that. But the media needs to actually be looking at the news and looking at the policy and telling us what it will do and not do.
We've been speaking with Steffi Woolhandler, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard University and co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
The New York Post is involved in another scandal. The latest episode finds Jared Paul Stern, a contributor to the paper's Page Six gossip column, under investigation for extortion. According to several news reports and supermarket mogul Ron Burkle, Stern solicited $220,000 from Burkle for protection against false or negative coverage in the column. Though no arrests have been made so far, the case is under investigation by the U.S. Attorney and the FBI. New York Observer columnist and Post critic Joe Connison says the Page Six affair is not exactly out of character. In his April 17th column, Post Scandal Reflects the Murdoch Method, Connison says Stern may only be following an example set by his boss, Rupert Murdoch. Joe Connison, welcome back to Counterspin.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Joe, tell us how Stern's behavior, allegedly shaking down a subject, is similar to Rupert Murdoch's.
Well, the aim of my column was to show that the behavior that's attributed to Page Six, and particularly to Jared Paul Stern, who has been there at the Post for 10 years, actually, really reflects a broader lack of ethical standards in News Corporation, and particularly in the way that Rupert Murdoch has used his media properties to reward and punish people over the years. And I hark back all the way to 1980, when he wanted a loan from the federal government. He was still an Australian citizen then. He wanted a loan from the federal government, almost $300 million, to finance the purchase of Boeing jets by an Australian airline that he was a part owner of. And he went to Washington, met with the head of the Export-Import Bank, which makes those loans, and then had lunch with President Carter, who was in the midst of a very furious primary campaign against Senator Edward Kennedy. And the New York primary was coming up. And within days after Murdoch's meeting with President Carter, the Post endorsed Jimmy Carter for another term as president in the New York primary, urged Democrats to vote for him. I believe, as I recall, the endorsement was on the front page, which is kind of typical of the Post. And a few days after that, the Export-Import Bank loan came through for Murdoch to the tune of $290 million. So that was all a coincidence. I mean, Murdoch later testified under oath and before the Senate Banking Committee that was all just a coincidence, but he admitted that it looked bad and said he would never do anything like that again. But of course he did. He went on to use book contracts as the main kind of source of rewards for politicians that he wanted to curry favor with. I think you probably remember he gave a $4.5 million book contract to Newt Gingrich within weeks after Gingrich became the House Speaker. It was one of the most bald attempts at a bribe, really, that anybody's ever seen in journalism, I think. Murdoch is what my old and very much bereaved colleague Jack Newfield used to call on the give. Rather than on the take. He is constantly cutting big checks to politicians of every stripe. He rather infamously bought a two-volume biography of Deng Xiaoping, the former Chinese dictator, from which he gave a contract to Deng's daughter, Deng Rong, to write this terrible book about Deng Xiaoping. $1 million to her. At the same time, of course, that he's seeking broadcast licenses and other kinds of favors from the Chinese government. So this goes on and on. There's example after example of this. Margaret Thatcher got millions of pounds from the Murdoch organization while having done many, many favors for him as prime minister in the UK. And it's as Jared Stern says on the famous videotape, it's a little bit like the mafia.
You're saying Murdoch has regularly traded favors. You've just given us a small sample of those. In China, of course, he traded favors with the government for withholding BBC coverage.
He he did that, and he also tried to suppress Chris Patten's book about Hong Kong. Chris Patten was the former British diplomat who was running Hong Kong before it was turned over to China again, and Patten wrote a very good book about China and Hong Kong that was supposed to be published by HarperCollins, and Murdoch suppressed it. It was published; it had to be published elsewhere because he didn't want to annoy the Chinese government.
Well, Bill O'Reilly, who also works for Rupert Murdoch, recently said that Air America should be investigated by election officials because, since it loses money, it's obviously, quote, simply there to help liberal political candidates, close quote. Perhaps the New York Post should be investigated on the same grounds. Joe Connison, how closely does O'Reilly's description of Air America match that of the New York Post?
Well, O'Reilly's description of Air America is as close to reality as anything O'Reilly talks about. He's just an authoritarian who would like to shut up people he doesn't agree with. But if O'Reilly's formula were applied to his own, the company that he works for, there never would have been a Fox News channel, which lost hundreds of millions of dollars for years before it started to break even, and therefore could have been considered to be subsidized by News Corporation for political purposes. And the same obviously goes for the Post, which loses, people estimate, $25 million a year or more, and has done so for decades. The entire time that Murdoch has owned it, I believe the Post has been losing a great deal of money. Like the Washington Times, by the way, another right-wing outlet that has been subsidized probably to the tune of hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, by the Unification Church, Reverend Moon.
So, and they're both hardball political players, too.
Totally hardball political players. And if the test were making money, none of them would ever have existed. So, you know, O'Reilly's remarks are to be taken as seriously as anything else he says.
We've been speaking with Joe Connison. His New York Observer column can be read online at www.observer.com. Joe Connison, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's program or you'd like to hear previous programs, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.